It's easy to dismiss concepts or ideas that seem uncomfortable, confusing, or unreal. The Nebulous is a new podcast that explores perceptions about complex themes relating to the human experience and the ambiguities of the human mind. I'm Lexi Smith, and I invite you to challenge your beliefs, open your mind, and learn from a diverse group of people. Subscribe to The Nebulous today.
I've been hinting to this podcast. We've spent time exploring our human mind, specifically our third eye, and what we really may be capable of. We've talked about how mediums can connect with animals, how they show up in our dreams, and how we can even balance out their energy within their bodies. So let's take it to another level. What are animals' thoughts capable of? How do different species view and navigate the world? They could be a lot more intellectual and aware than we allow ourselves to believe.
I think they have senses. I don't know if it's really intelligence. It's conditioning in some respects, and it's instinct.
They only think about the now. They don't think about anything else. That's my theory anyway.
Intuitively, I think sometimes they're just as smart, if not smarter, than us.
The more experience that I have, and the more that we learn about wildlife and other species that share the planet, our knowledge base is shifting in the opposite direction. You know, animals that we thought were not involved in complex thought, it turns out that things are a little bit more complex than we thought. You get down to the cellular level, and yeah, there are animals that are like that. And they simply respond to light and dark and heat and electrical stimuli and that kind of thing, and that's all that's involved. But for more complex animals, I think the trend in our knowledge base is in the opposite direction. Animals tend to be more complex than we thought they were. 50 years from now, that may reverse. You know, may go back in a different direction.
This is Harry Peachy, the curator at Zoo Boise. He had retired from being the curator at both the Columbus and Indianapolis Zoo, but came out of retirement because he wasn't done learning and growing with these animals. His interest is in elephants specifically, but it does range to almost every mammal. Since all we do is observe animals and decide with our human brains what they're thinking and processing, we have limited knowledge about what they're actually contemplating and planning. For example, maybe you think you're coming to understand your pet dog or cat. But has the thought ever occurred to you of what it would be like to become close with a species you might find at the zoo? It makes me nervous to think about animal caretakers going into a den of lions or hyenas. But if these animals aren't killing them, there must be some sort of connection or maybe relatability there.
So the lions, for example, if the lions were up, the male always recognizes me, and he would come over to that viewing panel. So if he's sleeping, it's not worth getting up. But they do recognize you, and the dogs already, the painted dogs already will recognize me to the point where if I'm standing with a group, they'll see me in that crowd and pick me out. And, you know, I'll look over toward that exhibit, and they're standing there staring, you know. And they do that with their caretakers as well. These animals are incredibly intelligent, and they train very quickly. I went over there to watch a training session the other day, and the behavior that they were doing it so well. I said to the keepers, that's pretty amazing. How many training sessions had you done? That was the first one. And they were behaving as if it was something that they'd been doing for days.
In order to get close and personal with these types of animals, you obviously need to be very aware of your actions while dealing with them, even down to your nonverbals. Think about how in one culture, eye contact is a sign of respect, while in others, it's a sign of disrespect. It's kind of the same thing.
Be careful about giving some kind of a negative message to an animal when you're training them. And that can be in presentation, you know, how you stand. And the problem sometimes is that you need to recognize that what we may consider as positive appearance is negative to other animals. A lot of non-human primates threaten with a grin. And when we grin, it's because we're happy. It's a positive thing. But if you grin at a number of non-human primates, they're not going to see it that way. So you have to be cognizant of those things. And you'll either know it in advance, you're in a situation where someone will tell you, hey, don't grin at the macaques. They don't like it. They take it as a negative. Or you realize after a few interactions with the macaques that every time you smile, they go insane, you know. So you do, it is a factor, and it is something you have to be cognizant about. The best way to approach it is to just be somewhat passive And to recognize that, you know, you may talk baby talk to your dog at home, but it doesn't mean you can come here and talk baby talk to species here. For some it will work, some it won't. The thing is, they're learning at the same time that we are. So they learn if they work with a staff that is always talking baby talk, and they're doing it when they're feeding them and going through those positive things, they'll learn and they'll put it into context. But it may not be the way that you want to approach them initially. Again, like we said about expressions, you know, wide eyes for some primates are a threat as well. And you may become wide-eyed in amazement at something that you see an animal in the collection do, but that doesn't mean they're going to take it in a positive way.
One thing that also comes to mind is, what if one of the caretakers gets scared around an animal? These animals have to be aware that they could overpower a human at any given moment. So what if the animal does get the impression that the human is scared or intimidated? Is the old story of animals being able to smell your fear a myth, or is it the truth?
You always hear people talk about smelling fear, and that's not that far-fetched a notion. You know, we don't realize that we're smelling something and a perception occurs and we respond to that and we don't even recognize it. Certainly animals do. You know, it's funny though, one of the elephants and musk, males and musk, they produce a secretion from the temporal gland that has a very, very strong odor, and it communicates their status and state of mind. Musk is like rut in a deer. Okay, so an elephant and musk is not in a good mood and is more prone to be aggressive, et cetera, et cetera. Other elephants smell that, they know to leave that animal alone, but it's got a very testosterone-like smell to it. So, you know, there's an element of that that is a smell that we produce. And, you know, we don't always perceive it ourselves until you get in very extreme situations, but it's there all the time.
So smelling fear, real. But here's an issue elephants have to deal with that you probably would have never thought to be a problem.
There are reproductive pheromones in elephants, estrus pheromones that females submit. And they are chemically identical to some pheromones that a couple of species of moths use as well. And that's always kind of been intriguing, you know, because that elephant has to sort out the difference between a female that's communicating a reproductive status and a moth that happens to be there. And I'm not familiar enough with the moths to say that they don't overlap in range. I don't know if they do or don't. One of the things that we see when we look at endocrines in elephant serum is that the levels are incredibly low, much lower than we would see in other mammals. It's a small amount of these endocrines, but you see these cycles and you see behaviors that are associated with it, so you know they're having an impact, and that's kind of striking. And you wonder, when you talk about olfactory communication, does the same thing happen? I don't know. I'm sure there's been some work done with it in the last few years that I'm not familiar with. But it's just interesting that they would have an identical pheromone that plays such an important role in stimulating behavior to that occurs in a moth.
So the animals may be becoming aware of who their caretakers are and what they mean to them. So if animals are able to form this sense of connection with human beings, what's their emotional capacity like? Can animals, other than dogs, form real bonds or feelings? Do they even have feelings?
Just the assignment of emotion to an animal becomes controversial because there are physiological processes that result in behaviors that appear to us to be emotion. Elephants are another example. People will have a picture of an elephant with a secretion from the eye and say that elephant is crying, and the elephant's not crying. That has to do with dust in the eye and protecting the eye and that kind of a thing. That's not an emotional response. But I'm not sure that I would be comfortable saying that elephants don't have emotion. Coming back to see elephants that I hadn't seen for a few weeks and their response manifesting in that greeting ceremony makes me think that there's an emotional component to that. You know, that you know, the simplest way to say it is to say that they're happy to see you.
You're listening to an interview with Harry Peachy from Zoo Boise and his take on what might be going on inside the typical animal's head. We've broken down a little bit about how animals interact with humans, but what's interesting is within these interactions, animals tend to create their own unique and innovative ways to get messages across. Harry has a really funny and good example of this.
you know, if you're managing them right and you have the right relationship with them, that when these elephant calves would be frightened or scared, they would look to their human caretakers for protection and comfort as readily as they would mom. And I was working with this young male calf who, every time he was frightened by something, it could be, you know, a plane overhead or a guest yelling or, you know, a car backfiring or whatever, but something frightened him, he would run up to me or another handler that was there. And what he realized pretty quickly is that when he did that, we would move away, you know, it, either to deal with the situation or for whatever reason, but we weren't necessarily going to stand there with him. So what he started coming up and doing was stepping on my foot, because then I couldn't move. So if he was on my foot, I couldn't move. And what ended up happening is we had this animal and his mom for about 5 months, and like the second time he did that, he broke two toes on my foot. They were broken all summer. Because he did that again and again and again, would come up, and it wasn't just stepping. I mean, he would come up and, bam, he would plant his foot on my foot because then I couldn't leave.
Maybe elephants just have a big personality, but Harry also offered another story involving an elephant illustrating deceit.
We tried for a long time when we were managing elephants in human care. You got to get medications into them. They get sick or they're injured, they develop an infection, whatever, and they need to be treated. And the initial response, and because we do this with other species, was to try and mask that medication so that they eat it and don't know that they're eating it. But the problem with doing that with an elephant is if you take a pill and stick it in an apple and hand it to them to eat, they're going to take it with their trunk, which is their nose. It's a combination of their nose and their upper mouth. So they know it's there right away. And fooling them is a lost cause, you know. So what we decided very early on is that we would make it a trained behavior. So you would teach an elephant to take their medication, and then you would reinforce them. So you give them this yucky-tasting antibiotic, and then you give them a reinforcer afterwards. So they eat the bad thing, and they get the good thing. And when you treat elephants, and you're giving a drug, you have to give huge quantities.
So they've created this whole process that seemed to be a success. But it didn't take long for the elephant to also learn how to outsmart them.
So we had a male, a bull, and this was a big bull. This was an animal that was 11,000 pounds. What we were doing is we would give him the drugs, these capsules, and we would put them in an apple or a marshmallow or something that would hold them together. And then after he took them, we would give him something that he really liked for reinforcement. So we would call him up to this wall that had rails on it, a wall that's designed to protect the handler from the elephant. Give him his medication, give him his reinforcer, and then do that again. So what he started doing is you would give him this medication, and he would take it in his mouth, and he would walk in a circle around this enclosure and come back to you. And the circle was set up, so, you know, we're standing here in this corner. He's in a large room, and at the other side of that room, there's a doorway that he can go through to go into a hallway. So he started making this loop, and then he started going through the door into the hallway. And we thought, well, that's a little strange. I don't know why he would do that. But he would turn around, come back, and get his next dose of meds. And about the fifth time he did that, it occurred to me that, okay, I think I know what's going on. I went over there and looked, and what he was doing is he would take those meds, he would move out of sight, spit them out, and come back and get his reinforcer. Again, that's deceit. There is no other way to describe it. Doesn't mean he's deceitful, just means he's capable of deceit. And he figured out a way to get that positive reward without having to suffer through taking his medication.
Can you reprimand an elephant? I'm not sure. Maybe he deserves a reward for outsmarting the caretakers for a quick second. But as interested as I am in the emotional and intellectual aspects of an animal, I also wonder about family. Most animals live life thinking their job is to reproduce. But once they do they recognize or claim their offspring as their own? Or do they just feel complete that they were able to follow through with their natural instincts?
There are some species that, you know, they give birth and the babies are gone. And that's just the way it works. And there are other species, there's been some lab work that's done with rhesus macaques that indicates that they recognize kinship based on their increased probability of interacting in a positive way from animals that they're related to. And they think that what they're doing is recognizing facial features. Again, it's tough to verify, but that's us looking at these macaques and saying, well, they look alike. We know they're related, and we know that she responds more favorably to her than she does to this macaque down the line that she's not related to. You know, the implication is there that they're recognizing kinship.
Elephants aren't the only animal to engage in dishonest activities. Even waterfowl can take a part in it.
There's a pair here in Julia Davis Park that not only adopt other goslings, they seem to go out and kidnap them. And they end up with this group of, 35, 40, 45 goslings that are following them around. I have no idea why they would do that, you know. Obviously, they're not stealing them from other adults that are related. They're just stealing. One or both of them has this very strong parental drive, and that's how it manifests. And with goslings, they'll survive. It doesn't need to be mom. It just needs to be somebody to follow around and keep them from walking out into traffic and make sure they get to water and that kind of thing. And this pair of geese can do that.
And if animals have this idea that their purpose of life is to reproduce, then are they aware that they're reproducing to replace their life that will eventually end in death?
There's really two answers to that, because you can come up with a number of examples that verify that animals are aware of death in social peers who have died, who have passed on. And elephants are famous for that. Again, because they live in these social groups and have ties that exist for decades, when a member of that group dies, elephants exhibit what appears to be mourning. And they will examine the carcass, they will examine the bones, they will examine in particular the tusk. And as they travel in that area again, if there's a place where a conspecific has died, they oftentimes will divert from a normal pathway to go back and go to that area where that animal died. So, and they may spend some time there and then will get back on their path and go. Now, to say that they know that death is impending, that's a tough one. I don't even know how you would go about verifying that. You know, certainly we do. But elephants and some other species, and painted dogs are a species that can do this as well. Elephants and painted dogs are similar in that kinship is an important part of the group. It's not as mandatory or as important in painted dogs as it is in elephants, but it is an element, and animals that are together tend to be related to some degree. If they need help, if they're suffering in some way, they communicate that to other members of the group, and other members of the group will help them. So, you know, elephants have been observed helping other elephants to get up on their feet. Elephants have been observed picking up calves that have fallen and can't move and carrying them and moving them, you know. So there's some communication that occurs. There's some way that they sense that. Can you stretch that and say that they can imply that degree of suffering that leads to death? I don't know.
It's fun to speculate about. We don't know everything there is to know about animals because we can only observe so deeply into their natural lives. But Harry experiences life with several species that are in his zoo, and he observes firsthand their personalities and demeanors. He sees more than what most of us ever will, and he doesn't need everyone to be on the exact same page as him.
You know, if you've taken statistics, you know how aggravating it is when they say, you know, it has to occur with a 97% probability rate before we say it's real. Well, I'm willing to take 80%, you know. If it happens that often, it's real and it's something they can need to take into consideration. But there are going to be other variations of that behavior or event that will manifest. You know, we talk about things as if they're absolutes, and they're really not.
Thank you for listening to The Nebulous by Boise State Public Radio. I'm Lexi Smith. Music by Johnny Easton, Kevin McLeod, Alexander Hoff, Andreas Erickson, Topher Moore, and Alex Alina, and Keys of Moon. Sound design by Josh Lindgren and support staff Kelsey Thompson and Laramie Lavalla. Consider two different realities. One where free will exists.
We have a course of action that's available to us that we can undertake. Or we can refrain from undertaking that.
And one where it doesn't.
There's really no point in regretting any actions you performed that maybe didn't turn out so well because you couldn't have done otherwise.
Andrew Cortins, a philosopher,
on the next episode of The Nebulous, a podcast by Boise State Public Radio.